You're listening to The Founders News,
your source for inspiration and insights into the vast world of entrepreneurship. I'm your host, Nathaniel Johnson, and we interview founders, CEOs, and world changers to get a better grasp of what it truly means to be a founder. Taking preconceived ideas into mind-boggling realities. But there's so much more than a podcast, it's a community. We empower startups with law, accounting, consulting, and more. So tune into the end of this episode to get involved with our partners, resources, and YFS as a whole. Today, we speak with John Brendan Bedell, CEO of Opentrons LabWorks. Opentrons focuses on developing robots for biologists, making the manipulation of liquids a more efficient task with the precision and accuracy of their robots. These robots are specifically designed to handle minuscule amounts of liquids in order to handle biochemical or chemical reactions. Opentrons currently offers several different products, from various workstations to cutting-edge robots. Yet as the CEO of a company leading in the fields of life science and robotics, John didn't originally get a degree in these fields. In this episode, join us as we delve into John's journey to becoming CEO of Opentrons LabWorks.
So we'll start off with what or who has helped become the leader you are today.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, look, I'd say there's no substitute for just going out and doing things. Learning by doing, learning from failures is oftentimes some of the most efficient ways to grow as a leader or an entrepreneur. You know, the reason I kind of say that is that when you look back on something that you did, whether it worked out or didn't, there's so many different lenses and frameworks you can kind of apply to that and little insights that you can pull from those types of experiences that you can't get just from a book or from talking to someone. Because there's just a limited amount of information that someone that's super knowledgeable even has the bandwidth to be able to share to you, let alone be able to kind of convey all the nuances of complex decision making under uncertain circumstances, et cetera, et cetera. There's all these little kind of nuances that I think there's no substitute for just going out and doing something. You know, whether it's starting your own startup or, you know, working on a project or what have you.
Yeah, amazing. I know we definitely see that leadership skills and et cetera with Opentrons. Kind of want to jump back into your early childhood as well. Kind of looking over Opentrons, it's a very, I would say, niche-focused business, right? You know, dealing with these volumes of liquids and the kind of biochemical realm. Did you always have interest in chemistry? Was that kind of like a field you started to go into in the startup era? Or, you know, was that more of a later developed sort of attraction for you?
Yeah, no, so I don't have a life science or robotics background. Mm-hmm. So I was actually a history major in undergrad.
Oh, okay.
And then did my first startup in the comic book space.
Yeah.
Called Comixology.
We heard about that, Comixology.
Mobile devices, which also wasn't great training for robotics or life science kind of per se. Mm-hmm. What those experiences taught me at Comixology was how to build a startup, how to scale a startup, how to build a great team. And after selling that business to Amazon and spending a couple of years at Amazon, that gave me kind of the freedom to explore what I wanted to do next. And literally I kind of got into this business, getting involved at a biohacker space in Brooklyn called GenSpace, in which different folks, some with scientific backgrounds, but many from non-scientific backgrounds like myself, they're just interested in learning more about biology and getting hands-on experiences in the lab. And just by doing that, it just became obvious that there was a lot of opportunities within the life science space. And that's kind of really where the interest, but also which a lot of the, you know, opportunities that we found around applying, you know, new robotic techniques into the life science field.
Yeah, of course. I mean, gotta ask, you know, the fun question, you know, you were in comiXology, were you kind of looking at comic books in the past? Was maybe one of the aspirations being a superhero? I mean, like, I don't know that, you know, I used to look at comic books all the time.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was, you know, I would characterize myself as like a comic book reader, but not like a huge fan in the way that there certainly are folks that are huge fans, you know. And so even how I kind of decided to get kind of involved with the comic book business was just through exploration of what was out there. And so this, you know, this is winding back the clock to 2008, 2009, when kind of I was just graduating college in 2009, and you know, the startup just kind of started getting going. Digital content was like a new thing, right? Like the Apple App Store had been out for about a year. The Kindle platform had just launched. So like, you know, streaming everything was not yet a thing. And while I had an interest in comics, a lot of it just what came from just thinking about the market opportunities, right? So as someone fresh out of college, even if you had the view that streaming was going to be an important thing, what's actually the best kind of practical way to get your hands dirty and do something, you know, in that space? Are you going to try and build a startup that's going to immediately be competing heads on, you know, in a high stakes battle, you know, against, you know, Apple and Amazon trying to do a music startup or a streaming video startup? Or can I find a right kind of market segment that's big enough where you can build an exciting business, but also not a really intense point of competition against some of these really, really well capitalized companies? And so that was part of why I actually identified the comic book, you know, in industry as a place ripe for disruption, in the sense of, hey, there's over, you know, at the time, you know, on the order of $1 billion of comic books sold each year. So you could actually build a pretty big business. But it's not such a large market that that's going to be the first kind of place that Amazon and Apple and other companies are going to, you know, compete very kind of heavily. And so over a few year period, we were able to build a startup in the comic book space that quickly became a market leader before those companies really started trying to compete. And by the time they started to compete against us, we'd achieved enough scale that it never made economic sense for them to make the investment necessary to try and beat us. And so, you know, at the time we sold the business to Amazon, we had, you know, over 80% market share of digital comic books. And so a lot of things is, I think, finding that right kind of balance of really thinking through what are the right opportunities to go after that makes sense in a macro sense, but also in the practical sense that you yourself can get going against that right away. Right, in the case of the comic book business, right? So imagine if instead I was trying to get into movie streaming, right? Like, it's a much bigger challenge trying to go to big movie studios and say, hey, will you let me license the right to some of your movies? Versus when we started that business, we went to independent comic book artists and said, like, hey, will you put your content on our platform? We'll give you, like, you know, we'll give you, you know, a 70% kind of revenue, and we'll take 30 for ourselves. Yeah, sure, no problem. We'll do that, right? The first example probably requires large amounts of upfront capital, just having a highly experienced team, just to have the credibility for a large corporation to think about partnering with you. The other one, you can just literally, you yourself as, you know, a young person with, you know, a bit of focus and motivation, et cetera, can be going out and starting a business and doing those kind of deals. And we were able to kind of ladder up very quickly to, you know, ultimately having, you know, major companies like, you know, Marvel and DC, you know, or their respective parent companies, you know, giving us, you know, allowing us to acquire exclusive rights to content and all this kind of crazy stuff. But the key thing is like I said, finding the right balance is something that's big and interesting, but that there's a practical and sane way in which you yourself, given whatever your situation you're in at that moment in time, can get going to do stuff. That's, I think, the right kind of balance of how you do your first startup or undertake any kind of entrepreneurial endeavor.
Okay. So how do you decide who will be part of your team? Do you look at, like, traits, values, goals? Like, what do you look for?
Yeah, absolutely. And, right, so there's probably two major aspects, you know. So one is mission alignment, right? Particularly for early stage startups, you need to work really hard with very little promise of like guaranteed return, right? And so ultimately, if you're going to work that hard without a guarantee of success, you need to really care about the mission. How I specifically kind of parse if someone's just like likes a mission versus kind of really passionate is, you know, and I use this as a framework for myself. Is this a problem that, one, I feel so strongly that it needs to be solved, and two, that a startup is actually the best way to solve that problem? Because working at a large company, you, by definition, have access to a massive amount of resources and a massive amount of reach, and you can make a very significant impact. And there's just some problems that are just better to be solved by large companies. And there's other problems that, because of constraints of large companies, of their bureaucracy or of their business strategy, that prevents them from solving certain important problems that you need to do as a startup. And so oftentimes, whether it's looking for the, you know, mission alignment, you know, either for myself personally or even in other people, it's really important to convince yourself not only that this is an important or worthy cause, but that specifically doing a startup is the right or only way in which you can be meaningfully making inroads against that problem, right? Because like you could go to an NGO and try and solve that problem that way, or a large company, or in the government, right? There's lots of different ways problems are solved. It's not just startups, you know, writ large around the world. And then the other piece, which is I think more, you know, mundane that I look at in people is like, you do need to have subject matter expertise. You can't have a whole bunch of generalists that can solve a hard technical problem. You oftentimes have a finite amount of time as a startup to solve a problem, and maybe just having a few really smart people can just like reinvent the wheel in that industry and solve certain kind of hard problems. But it's a lot more efficient to have a strong point of view of where you're trying to innovate and where you're just incorporating kind of best practices, right? And it's oftentimes a red flag if you're trying to reinvent everything. Because if you're taking it's one thing to take like a technical risk, it's another thing to take a technical risk and a business model risk and a commercial risk and a finance risk and all these other kind of risks and layer that all on. That really increases your odds of failure. So you want to be very kind of thoughtful of where you're taking your risk, and oftentimes making sure that you have the right people with the right technical expertise is a great way to take out some of those risks. If you're selling it in a similar way as how this type of product is sold by competitors, maybe you should be getting the right kind of world-class experienced sales or marketing person that's well-versed on how to do that versus trying to, you know, reinvent the wheel. Or same thing can be said about different aspects of the technical problem for whatever you're doing.
And, you know, I love how you kind of talked about your initial, you know, focus on mission versus, you know, having people be compensated in certain ways or other people join a business. But when you mentioned bringing people onto the team, I mean, obviously, you know, you brought on yourself first. So I guess in the initial stages of OpenTron, we can talk about that a little bit. You know, what was your mission? What kind of made you kind of sell yourself on the business, make you, you know, work for yourself in that manner?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so when I was kind of, you know, involved in this biohacker space, one, it really opened my eyes to how inefficient lab work is and what a pain it is to manually execute these things. And it became very, very clear that if life science and biology kind of writ large is going to be able to make some big inroads on some of the hardest problems humanity is going to face over the next century. So when you kind of think about global warming, you know, food security, you know, disease and issues of health, life science holds likely a significant component of solutions to many kind of really hard problems in those areas. And fundamentally, you can either bet that we can just magically have more geniuses that can just come up with the genius insights and solve, like, you know, some of these problems. That's probably not a good bet, because I would guess that the frequency of really smart breakthrough scientists is probably, you know, a similar rate as a function of time. Two, you could be making the bet, well, there's just going to be more scientists. It's like, well, you know, the number of scientists growing, you know, is increasing each year by like a few percent. And so maybe, you know, you play out a few decades, you've doubled the number of scientists. You've not, like, there's not a legitimate pathway in which, like, 20 years from now, that there's going to be 20 times as many scientists working on problems, right? Like, just, you know, the amount of time that it takes to, like, become an expert, the number of PhDs that are being made each year. So then fundamentally, you need to therefore believe that if we're going to make big inroads to some of these problems, is that we need to find ways for scientists to be far more productive than they are now, right? And I kind of use the analogy of, you know, software engineering, right? So when you think about the productivity of a software engineer now versus 20 or 30 years ago, it's night and day, right? You can have a small team build, you know, something like build OpenAI and ChatGPT, right? That was fundamentally built by like 50 engineers. Or you can have various, you know, apps that some, you know, a team of 20 people make and is used by hundreds of millions of people, right? That type of thing was just unthinkable 30 years ago, because you're mired with lower level problems that you need to solve first. Like, oh, how do we even, you know, host stuff? Well, we have to make our own on-prem server, you know. Well, how do we get people to use it? It's like, well, the internet doesn't exist yet, so, like, we don't even, you know, right? Like, how do we even distribute it? Life science needs to have a more advanced tool set than just doing things manually to be able to scale up that kind of efficiency. And so, one, when you look at these PhDs that spend a significant amount of their time manual executing lab work, like, well, shouldn't that all be automated? And then the second question, of course, is that if it's automated, why can't they run 10 times or 100 times as much stuff and therefore generate 10 or 100 times more, you know, data, and so on and so forth? And so it's my view that the digitization of the lab, the automation of the lab, so that scientists can be abstracted away from the nitty-gritty of executing lab work is the same kind of abstraction that we've seen with software engineers that just think about tossing something into on a cloud service versus needing to think about, like, machine code on a, you know, on a processor, right? And when you enable scientists to think higher and higher level in the same way that software engineers have had the luxury of being able to do, as you look at the progression over the past few decades, I think that's going to be your pathway to 10x the amount of innovation in life science. And so that's kind of the kernel of what, you know, I kind of observed, you know, and inspired me to kind of, you know, want to build up this business.
Kind of just leading up on that in general, wanted to really talk about, you know, you're mentioning that this whole aspect of digitization, right, of labs, and mm-hmm. I think over the past few years we've seen, you know, so many companies be digitized, you know, looking at Uber, digitizing, you know, how travel's working on a car front, you know, homes with, you know, Airbnb, et cetera. So, you know, because I guess you're, you know, part of the digitization on the lab front, ultimately, like, when we reach an Internet of Things place where, you know, there's digitization everywhere, I don't know, what are your kind of thoughts on that future? A lot of people are worried about maybe a lack of jobs happening because there's digitization, but ultimately, like, you know, parsable out. But I mean, are you a proponent of it? I mean, I know OpenTrans is, but how's your stance on that?
Yeah, you know, and so, you know, I'll respond to that specifically within life science, you know, first. Okay. We can talk about it more broadly. And so what I think is unique in our space is that you have these highly trained individuals that are manually doing work, and they don't want to be. They got a PhD not because they're really good at using their hands. They got a PhD because they're really smart, right? And want to be spending their time doing some of these higher level things. And so we find that, at least in our space, the biggest adopters of our robotics and technology are the people that want to automate what they are spending most of their day doing so they can do more interesting, higher value, higher level tasks. The nice thing is, so one is that I think many people that are looking to automate themselves out of the job they're actually looking to automate themselves out of that job because they'd rather be doing a different job within life science. Because they'd rather be designing experiments rather than running experiments. The second piece is, argue that many of the hard problems that are trying to be solved in life science, when you think about like coming up with new cures of cancer and, you know, yada yada, right? Data generation is a important aspect of that. And as we've seen in life science as well as in other spaces, like if you can just like generate like 1,000 times more data, some of these problems that used to be really hard and intractable start becoming tractable. But unlike other fields, generating the data is a really big, big pain because you have to do this manual lab work. And it's one thing to say like, oh yeah, let's scale up our data generation by 1,000x. Sure, your cloud servers can support that, but that means also by extension, you need to scale up your lab operation by 1,000-fold. And are you going to expand your lab 1,000-fold, or are you going to find ways to automate and therefore in your same footprint, in same resource set, be able to increase your output 1,000-fold. It's the latter which fundamentally has to be the case. Because otherwise, and you'll find this, like some of these older labs, particularly diagnostic labs, there's like labs that are literally like 1 million square feet. Like it's insane. And you can't scale stuff, you know, infinitely. It just becomes impossible to control or manage. And if you can scale things because it's all automated, it's a completely different story.
Yeah, at OpenTrans, they're used in like thousands of academic and research labs. So with that being said, what is your long-term vision for OpenTrans and like expansion?
Yeah, absolutely. And so our view is that by making automation in labs easy and affordable to use, we can make it ubiquitous across all labs around the world. Right now, less than 10% of labs have access to these tools. With us bringing down the price tenfold and making them easier and easier to use, we want to put these in the hands of all scientists worldwide. And so that's really what we're driving as a business.
And I guess, like, you know, through enabling all these scientists to, you know, have this technology to create and innovate, et cetera, I mean, in the kind of, I guess, biochemical space and whatnot, what's, I guess, your dream of what this tech could be used for?
Yeah, it's really amazing what he's in. The other kind of piece I would kind of highlight is that we're unique in that we're an open source platform. And so the applications developed by our customers can be used by other customers and built upon. Okay. And I'll use kind of COVID as a really kind of great example of that. And so when COVID broke out, our robot was one of the first robots to be automating the testing of COVID because we happened to be in one of the CDC labs that was developing the original assay for the U.S. And then instantaneously, because we had thousands of robots, thousands of our customers around the world started using our robot for COVID testing. And because it's open source, they were able to kind of share best practices and very quickly kind of enable our robots to be used very kind of efficiently against that. We never designed our robots for high throughput diagnostic testing of a disease we'd never even kind of imagined, you know, previously. So that at least that kind of as an example of kind of the power of affordable automation of an open source community that you can respond to, you know, grand challenges, you know, even when they come up kind of suddenly. And, you know, and with that as the next kind of extension of that is that when the city of New York asked us to set up COVID testing capacity, using about 40 of our robots, we stood up a lab here in New York, and we stood that up in 2 weeks. And that lab that we set up in 2 weeks was testing the majority of all COVID tests run in New York City. And so we tested over 15 million people out of our a lab that we set up. Mm. The pace which we were able to move was made possible because of that community, because of the affordability of our tools. And, you know, I think we saved the city of New York over $1 billion in testing costs. And that's just one, you know, these are just all just like, you know, individual examples. I can point to, you know, thousands of other customers that have done all sorts of interesting things, you know, outside of like, you know, the pandemic, and using our system to kind of really push what is possible in the lab.
I mean, saving billions of dollars for New York, just, you know, one small thing, I don't know, for sure. That's amazing. And then, you know, finally just to close it off, was just to ask, I guess, you know, someone, let's say a student, you know, this student founder podcast at the end of the day, trying to get into a field as niche and as in-depth as life sciences, what would you be your best advice to them? You know, is it kind of to gain that industry experience through life science first and tackle it head on, or maybe just jump right in if they have the tools and resources now?
Yeah, I'd really recommend when you're young just to try things, right? It's usually a bad strategy of like, I'm not sure, like, I want to be a life science entrepreneur. I really don't know what that means. I'm going to go get a PhD, and then I'm going to start that, right? Like, those are really big upfront commitments. You might find that you don't like things. And so I always encourage you to find really fast, easy, and efficient ways to actually figure out what you're passionate about. And like I said, like I had no robotics or life science kind of background prior to doing this business. And I was like, this is something that I'm curious about as a hobby. And so I went to a biohacker space because that was a place where I could kind of tinker and play around, because you just can't go to like Pfizer and say, hey, I'm interested in, you know, right? Can I tinker around in your lab? No. So I'd recommend just getting kind of creative and just get your hands dirty as quickly as possible, because you'll be surprised when you actually get your hands dirty how quickly you can learn whether you actually are passionate about it, but also more importantly, what's wrong or inefficient with kind of how that whole industry is kind of set up. And then if you're, you know, bright and curious, you'll figure out how to convert that into a, you know, a potential startup or business if that's your kind of your inclination.
And are there any, like, books, comic books, or podcasts you would recommend?
Yeah, you know, honestly, like I said, like, this kind of keeping what I was saying before is that, like, no offense to you guys at all, like, podcasts are great, but, like, I just recommend just doing things. There's no substitute for doing things. Like, you can read and study. Like, it's like, you know, like, would you rather have the doctor that's never operated on someone but has read every single book, or would you rather have the doctor that's operated, you know, might not have been the best, you know, student in med school, but has operated on 10,000 people doing this procedure, right? Like, there is really no substitute for doing things, and oftentimes there's a tendency to overstudy and over-intellectualize.
Yeah.
And when you do that, you miss out on all the kind of nuances or things that the people that are writing the books or telling the podcast missed out on, because it's those gaps is really what matters, right? Yeah. And only by doing it do you have the opportunity to observe those, and therefore that can be the opportunity for a startup. Because like, look, like if someone on a podcast is telling you about an interesting idea that could be the basis of a startup, that means that like that idea has probably been thought over and worn by so many people. The really interesting things come from the things that have not yet come to pass, and there's no substitute for actually look, getting your hands dirty and identifying those yourselves. Those are oftentimes the most interesting opportunities.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, John, thank you so much for coming on. You know, I love that last piece of insight. You know, if we're talking about ideas on the spot, you know, I mean, it's probably been thought of before, but thank you so much and really appreciate you coming on.
Great. Thank you.
Hey y'all, Sean here with a quick sign-off. Thanks again for tuning into this episode. If you're a founder, entrepreneur, or world changer of any sort, be sure to check out some of our partners to accelerate your business ventures. Whether it's consultation with Adventist Law, bookkeeping and ideation with Mighty Startup, accounting or advisory with AKM Global, or even tax help with Heartbeat and Partners, YFS will continue to build and support a strong community of student founders and entrepreneurs. And with our partners, Speaker Network, will continue to grow and accelerate your ventures. Peace.